Hi, boys and girls. Like you, Santa is listening to the Merry Little Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
Merry Christmas and welcome to the Merry Little Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com. My name is Jeff Westover, head Christmas time traveler at the Merry Forums of MyMerryChristmas.com, where we are closing in on our 29th birthday this year. This episode of the Merry Little Podcast is sponsored by the Magic Christmas Ornament. It's a book, it's an ornament, and it's a new family tradition that explores all that is magical at Christmas. Read about this great tradition and check out the book at MagicChristmasBulb.com. In our last episode, we laid the foundation for a discussion of the Victorian Christmas by talking about what made Queen Victoria such a celebrant of Christmas. We discovered that Christmas wasn't new or unknown to her as a child growing up, and that she really didn't have much of anything at all to do with the trends of the 19th century Christmas, than to have a picture of the Christmas that she was already celebrating carried in newspapers all around the world. In fact, that whole episode underscored the fact that Christmas was indeed widely celebrated, despite what historians and websites everywhere have to say today. Christmas was, in fact, noted everywhere, consistently, year after year after year, in the 19th century. In this episode, we only present even more evidence of that as we explore just what Christmas during the Victorian era was actually like. Christmas in what was known as New Spain was brought by Catholic explorers more than 400 years ago. Back in the year 1590, an explorer named Gaspar Castaño de Sosa mentioned in his journal the small bonfires that had been lit by others of his party to guide a lost scout back to camp. Luminarias is what he called those bonfires, giving birth to a Christmas tradition that is still a thing these days in New Mexico and really all over the southwest of the United States. Some call them farolitos, which means little lanterns. You see, when Spanish traders visited the Philippines in the mid-19th century and brought back flat-bottom brown bags known as Chinese paper lanterns, the tradition spread of leaving out luminarias on Christmas Eve to light the way for the Holy Family. In that part of the world, and indeed really all over South America, the Latino culture celebrates Las Posadas, a 9-day celebration before Christmas that commemorates the journey of Mary and Joseph before Christ was born. This is just one of many examples of the evolution of Christmas during the Victorian era. Traditions born of blended events, mixed with religious symbolism, in a land still foraging, really, for its identity. You see, the Victorian era was not about the Christmas stuff of England, or of Queen Victoria, or of Charles Dickens. So many from so far brought so much to Christmas all together at one time during the Victorian era. Christmas would be a hallmark of the 19th century, a time when America was searching for its collective soul, especially after the tremendous losses of the American Civil War. That identity was galvanized by the blending of many nationalities who brought with them their many traditions from far away that were taught to them by those who came before. Just as we noted in the last episode, Queen Victoria never could have celebrated Christmas without the traditions of her 18th century grandmother, Queen Charlotte. We know that George Washington celebrated Christmas, as did John Adams and Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. And these were all great men we remember as patriots and declaration signers and, in most cases, presidents. But they all came from somewhere different, yet they all held Christmas in common. And so too did other prominent figures from before the Victorian era. If you want a great Christmas story, look up the Christmases of Lewis and Clark and the Corps of Discovery from the years of 1803 to 1805. It's one of my favorite Christmas stories ever. All of these facts speak to a thriving tradition of Christmas everywhere you could look, in both the Old World and the New World, before what we called the popular Christmas of the Victorian era. But it is the Victorian era that we credit in explaining what we do with Christmas today. It was an era of grand Christmas experiences that united people of faith with those who claimed no belief. It was a time when everything about Christmas evolved. This could not have happened if they were not celebrating Christmas already. Just as the natives of New Mexico celebrated Christmas in ways that still make them very unique and yet very American at the same time, we have literally thousands of other stories of the same from all over. Take, for example, the city of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, founded in the 1740s. It was a community that was given a Christmas name when it was chartered on Christmas Eve. Are you going to tell me that they didn't celebrate Christmas there in the 1740s? Yes, the Moravians of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania were a German religious sect that came to the New World for many of the same reasons that the Puritans and Pilgrims did 100 years before. And they brought their Christmas with them and made it their identity, America's Christmas city, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. A claim to fame that they have stubbornly clung to, even though in their 270-year history of the place, it has obviously become much, much more diverse than when it started out. People and belief change, but not the love of Christmas. When I was a kid, and being a bookworm, the 19th century in my young mind was Little House on the Prairie. Now, I'm not talking about the television show, I'm talking about the books, where Christmas was a scene in the states of Wisconsin, Minnesota, and out on the plains in the Dakotas. In researching those places for this episode, guess what I found? I found that Laura Ingalls Wilder was telling the truth. Christmas was celebrated every year in the simple pioneer ways exactly as she described in the books. Stockings were hung, Santa came, Christmas was celebrated with family and food, almost all of it entirely homemade. So over the course of the last 3 episodes or so of the Merry Little Podcast, we have consistently found that Christmas was celebrated every year in nearly every place that we have looked in the 17th century, the 18th century, and the 19th century. And of course, it was a little different from one location to the next, but it was still Christmas. The Victorian era simply brought it all together. The era is unnecessarily credited with the invention of so many things we now use in the celebration of the modern Christmas. But we need to stop thinking of it as inventing. We should consider the Victorian era a time of evolving, of unifying, and of improving, if you will, what Christmas is, was, and will forever be. It took the contributions of a lot of people coming from so many diverse parts of the world in order for all of that to happen. In this episode, be prepared to be blown away by everything Christmas that happened in the second half of the 19th century, known as the Victorian era. Much of it was not new. It was just something brought from somewhere else and made better in every single case.
Bending near the earth to touch still through the cloven skies. They come with peaceful wings unfurled, and still their heavenly music floats o'er all the weary world. Above its sad and lowly plains, they bend on hovering wing, and ever o'er its babel sounds the
This familiar Christmas song is a product of the Victorian era of Christmas. It was beautifully performed for us by the Gardner Sisters, whose music videos of Christmas we have featured before at My Merry Christmas. We selected their version for this song for its simplicity and its sheer beauty, and we're grateful for their gracious contribution to this episode. You can learn more about their music at GardnerSisters.com or look them up on YouTube. They've got a lot of great stuff there. Written in 1849, this song was written by Edmund Sears, and he was a pastor for the Unitarian Church in Wayland, Massachusetts. Unlike most composers of famous Christmas music during his time, Sears only wrote two hymns ever, and this was one of them. Sears was distressed, you see, when he wrote this song. The words of this song are ponderous for us in the troubled year of 2020. You see, Sears was a bit disturbed over the trouble of his time back in 1849. Revolutions in Europe and the U.S. war with Mexico raged. Part of what he wrote goes like this: "Yet with the woes of sin and strife, the world has suffered long. Beneath the angel strain have rolled 2,000 years of wrong. And man, at war with man, hears not the love song which they bring. Oh, hush the noise, ye men of strife, and hear the angel sing." Wow, how can such words not apply to us today? I've decided that music as a subtopic related to the Victorian era of Christmas could possibly be an episode or two all by itself. And we'll be highlighting some of that music from here on out in this episode, just like we did in the last episode. But this song in particular, and a few others like it, actually teaches something about Christmas in the 19th century. It teaches that Christmas then just didn't happen without the church. From the very first day of the century to the very last, newspapers overwhelmingly featured churches in the reporting of the news of Christmas, both in England and in America. The nature of their reporting was simple: Christmas celebration, Christmas decorations, and especially Christmas music was all church activity. That's not to say Christmas didn't happen outside the church, as it did. But clearly, church was at the heart of the celebration of Christmas. This is actually something to consider in the case of America. You'll remember from our discussions of the Puritan and Pilgrim Christmases of the 17th century, Christmas wasn't exactly a holy practice in medieval times. Many came to the New World to escape both churches and the Christmas that they celebrated in the Old World. Christmas, if you recall, was at the very heart of the British Civil War. But in coming to the New World, folks brought with them two things that they really wanted with their freedom. They brought the liberty of faith that they desired, and they brought their own brand of Christmas with them. They also brought with them an open mind. This was the hope of 18th century crossover writers in Washington Irving and Clement Clark Moore. As we have explained before, they adopted and then promoted the saint known as Nicholas to New Yorkers who only knew Christmas to be a free-for-all on the streets of what had always been a great city in American history. If they could create a character of magic, one that played to the hearts of children and worked within the circle of families, they could calm down the riots of Christmas known in the big cities of New York and Philadelphia and Charleston and New Orleans. What Irving and Moore also knew was that the great melting pot of New York was quickly becoming a very diverse community. What they needed was someone everyone could adopt. The first half of the 19th century saw newspapers and books leading the culture charge of the introduction of new ideas in America. It could take a while at first for a new book from Europe to make it to the United States, but when one did, the chances of widespread popularity of a work could really improve. I figured this out in exploring the name of my fourth great-grandfather. His name is very unique for any time period in history. His first and middle names are Edwin Ruthven. He was born in 1824. Now, there's nothing within our family history anywhere that could suggest the use of these names. It was popular during these years and common back in those days to name a first child after someone who had come before. A father, a grandfather, a great-grandfather, an uncle, whatever. For years, I searched for answers why in family journals and letters that this didn't happen with Edwin. Where did his name come from? Well, I came up empty-handed. Until one day, out of the blue, the thought occurred to me to Google the most popular book that was published in the United States between 1815 and 1825. And what came up was a book written in 1808 titled The Scottish Chiefs by Jane Porter. And the story is based in 14th century Scotland and chronicles the romantic and heroic adventures of Sir William Wallace, Robert the Bruce, and Edwin Ruthven. I had my answer. Turns out that his mother, one of my great-grandmothers, was a bookworm as a child, and when she was a teenager, this book hit the big time in America. It was quite literally the Harry Potter of its day. It taught me how books, poems, and newspapers at that time were voraciously consumed. For Christmas, nothing highlighted that better than the works of Washington Irving and Clement Clark Moore. By their adoption of St. Nicholas and tying him so heavily to the celebration of Christmas, they accomplished two things, especially for the big city Christmas. First, they got Christmas off the streets and back into the homes. And they also pushed people back into the churches. After all, Nicholas was a saint, and he was revered by many faiths and nationalities. More often than not, it was the sacred elements that were most prevalent in the Victorian era of Christmas, whether it was in books, newspapers, poems, songs, and dramatic works of the stage. That religious dominance, believe it or not, helped to create the first real superstars of American pop culture, and you'll be shocked to find out who they were. We'll be right back after this word from our sponsor.
7-year-old Victoria is so excited. It's a very special Christmas Eve. Tonight, her father will tell the story of their family's magic Christmas ornament. How when he was Victoria's age, he followed tiny footprints through the woods to a mysterious old tree. Inside, something was brightly shining. It was a magic Christmas ornament. Her father took it home and put it on his family's Christmas tree. But was this ornament really magical? Victoria and her brothers went to bed. In the middle of the night, they tiptoed downstairs to see the ornament again. To their amazement, the ornament lit up before their eyes, and they were whisked to Santa's workshop, the happiest place on earth. What happens next is almost unbelievable. See for yourself in The Magic Christmas Ornament.
Our thanks to Jim Barbato, author of The Magic Christmas Ornament, for sponsoring this episode of the Merry Little Podcast. You can learn more about his book at magicchristmasbulb.com.
Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh, for the fields we go, laughing on the way. Bells on bobtails ring, making spirits bright. What fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing
night. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in one horse open sleigh. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in one horse open sleigh.
The song you just heard was recorded in 1898, and it is one of the most common tunes in the world, so well known that not a Christmas season can pass without us hearing it at least dozens of times every year. The song was a phenomenon in the days before sound recordings in the 19th century, and it remains embroiled in mystery and debate and controversy here in the 21st century. Why and how did Jingle Bells become associated with Christmas? Folks these days tend to focus on the sound of the bells as a Christmas association. They did the same back in the day, too, as well, because sleigh bells are inherently merry. And looking back through media all through the 19th century, even long before the date of 1857 when Jingle Bells was written, sleigh bells were a subject that conveyed the joy and the fun of the Christmas season. It should be remembered that when Clement Clark Moore wrote A Visit from St. Nicholas, it came as an inspiration from a sleigh ride he took on Christmas Eve, his sleigh driver being old but lively and quick. And while he doesn't mention bells in St. Nicholas's visit, he does put Santa in a sleigh. Sleigh rides were a genuine sport in both the 18th and 19th century. Come winter, especially in areas of the far north where the snow was deep, sleighs were the de facto means of winter transportation. And they could be pretty fast, comparatively speaking, because you didn't really have to stick to roads when you were in sleighs. In fact, if you want a fascinating look at the history of sleighs, take a listen to an episode of the Sleigh Bells and Mistletoe podcast. Ricky Meese talks sleigh history in episode number 14 with a modern-day restorer of classic sleighs. It's a fascinating look at Christmas past, and it backs a lot of what we're saying here about sleighs. Sleigh rides were practical in the winter, and bells were a means of extending their practicality. Sleighs could glide almost silently in the snow, and if there was bad weather or fog, bells were essential in communicating that a fast-moving vehicle was close by. Now, we tend to gravitate to the images of Currier and Ives when thinking of sleighs in the 19th century. It's interesting to note that Currier and Ives, because of their artistic efforts in lithography, well, they perpetuated the romantic traditions of country sleigh rides and Victorian Christmas. Their prints were wildly successful in their day because what they portrayed and how they connected with those who celebrated Christmas was very real. What they showed is what really happened. But one of the things not readily shown in the prints by Currier and Ives is that sleighing was as much, if not more so, of a city event as it was a country pastime. In fact, the racing element spoken of in the song Jingle Bells was most likely associated with city living at Christmas time, when racing up and down the broad city streets was definitely in fashion. By the time James Lord Pierpont wrote Jingle Bells in the mid-1850s, it was for him a memory of winter and Christmas that inspired the song. Now, we won't use this episode to tell the whole incredible history of Pierpont and the song Jingle Bells, other than to say this. Historians point out that Jingle Bells was not written for Christmas. It was written and released at Thanksgiving. To me, that's hardly the point. The bigger fact, and this is mentioned by nearly no one, is that the song was launched at a church meeting. Again, the church was central to yet another song of Christmas, even if it was secular in nature, which Jingle Bells most certainly is. In fact, Jingle Bells is not only secular, but some say for its time it could have been downright scandalous. The song, after all, is about driving fast, picking up girls, and it advises to, quote, go at it while you're young. You see, sleigh rides were not easy. There's a reason why young people dominated the sport and why old folks tended to reminisce about sleigh riding in the books and the poems and the songs of the 19th century. It was a hard sport. In fact, an 1873 newspaper article about a Christmas program that featured several songs, including Jingle Bells, made an interesting side note that I had to research further. In the article, they gave Ben Franklin, of all people, a hard time. You see, Franklin once opined, and famously enough so that a newspaper article in 1873 referenced it, that sleigh riding was like sitting in a bathtub of ice water and having a bell incessantly rung in your ears. The article mocked Franklin for being a humbug to something so cherished and fun at Christmas as riding in a sleigh. Oh, and by the way, Jingle Bells was described in this article as being robustly performed by the entire crowd, both young and old, and by memory. Now, does that sound like a song that nobody knew about to you? This wasn't even 20 years after the song was published. Historians tell us, and Google can confirm this, that Jingle Bells did not become popular until decades later when it was recorded and distributed, and I can tell you this is most certainly false. The media in the 1860s, 70s, 80s, and 90s were filled of the song being used at holiday gatherings at churches, on university campuses, in community events, and other Christmas-associated gatherings. It is usually described as a rousing, laughter-filled moment of simple Christmas joy that every age in the audience enjoys. Some are quick to call Jingle Bells a drinking song, surmised that Pierpont wrote the song in a Georgia tavern, and that the jingle of bells was akin to the ice tinkling in a drink. Now, that's too far-fetched for me of a theory. In addition, a truly whacked history of the song purports to label it racist because Pierpont did write a fair amount of music for minstrel shows, and there is ample proof that Jingle Bells was performed in blackface in many places during the 19th century. I don't take any issue with those facts, as I was able to confirm them independently through newspapers of the time. But those facts do not make the song racist. Silent Night, for that matter, was performed similarly during the 19th century minstrel shows and in blackface, and nobody's calling out that song as racist. No, Jingle Bells, as written, would have made Pierpont rich, but it didn't, only because he didn't live long enough to see what could happen to the song after recordings started to come out. And while White Christmas occupies a place in Christmas history as the highest-selling single of Christmas all time, I think an argument can be made that Jingle Bells passes it easily. Jingle Bells had 80 years head start on White Christmas and sold more copies in print than White Christmas ever will, and I would argue that the song has been recorded by thousands of more artists than even the Great White Christmas. Jingle Bells was popular in the 19th century for very simple reasons. First, it was relatable because sleighing was a legitimate form of sports and entertainment that did happen frequently at Christmas time. Second, it's a happy song, simple enough that even the very young could learn it just by hearing it one time. And third, it was a crowd pleaser. It continues to be a crowd pleaser, something that makes you smile, laugh, and feel the joy in hearing. People today know Pierpont's name. He's a first ballot nominee for the Christmas Hall of Fame. Jingle Bells, like A Christmas Carol, has never diminished in its popularity, ever. And one final point here that needs to be brought up. Jingle Bells is the first secular hit of Christmas that we can find. The fact that it came out at Thanksgiving is really important because it was around this time when Jingle Bells was written that Thanksgiving and having a pilgrim heritage was really a hot thing in American culture. We point you to our podcast episode titled Why Christmas Begins with Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is an integral part of the 19th century Christmas. Oh, and for that matter, force yourself to listen to my favorite episode of all time that we've called Pumpkin Love. The crossover not only of Christmas in time, but also in seasonal transitions is really important to understand the passionate celebration of Christmas in the 19th century.
Well, there was three wise men traveled from afar. Well, there was three wise men traveled from afar. And their names was Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar. You know, they studied the heavens and they gazed upon the stars. Yeah, they studied the heavens and they gazed upon the stars. And their names was Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar. It was late one night, they was walking out on the sand. It was late one night, they was walking out on the sand. he saw a star shining bright on a distant land. Then he heard a voice like the angels when they sing. Yeah, they heard a voice like the angels when they sing. Singing hallelujah to the baby king.
Now that song is definitely not from the 19th century, but the many myths that it perpetuates most certainly come from the 19th century. You see, if it was a clear trend in the 19th century Victoria era Christmases that nobody talks about, it's the Magi. They were hot as a Christmas theme in the 19th century. They were popular in song, popular in decorating, popular in art, and popular in everyday conversation about Christmas. This is a fact I've uncovered almost exclusively from research in the media from the time and from personal journals that we could review. I couldn't find a single book to support this idea by any historian, and nothing really from Google and searching online. In fact, what I found overall about the Christmas of the Victorian era were glowing generalities that showed a lot of error. I found that modern online sources like Victoria Magazine say that the Victorian era ended in 1901 with the death of Queen Victoria. Okay, I get that. But in the same paragraph, they claim families sat around reading The Gift of the Magi together during the Victorian era. Well, that's not true. It can't be true. The Gift of the Magi was a 20th century Christmas thing, written in 1905, after the Victorian era was so-called over. I think their point is that Christmas was a family affair in the 19th century. And of course it was. In both England and the United States, large families were common, and they had to be. It was an agrarian society that depended upon families to make small farms work. It had always been that way since the early 1600s when the Pilgrims arrived. If you go back to our fun episode about pumpkin love, you'll see how this worked with early cherished traditions of Christmas celebrations, of which pumpkin was just one. It's hilarious now to think that the rugged newspapers of that day in the 1600s calculated that an average of 10 pumpkin pies per family were consumed every holiday season. Now that didn't happen just because they loved the humble pumpkin. That happened because they also had very large families. So no doubt the things that they tell us about family celebration of Christmas during the Victorian era was a thing. That makes total sense to me. But historians, it seems to me, seem to miss the Magi as being much of a part of the Victorian era Christmas and how families celebrated them, the Magi. I'm telling you, the Magi were a big, big part of the 19th century Christmas, and it took me a lot of hours to figure out why. You see, in perusing the newspapers of both Europe and North America in the 19th century, you could see very clear patterns of Christmas reference. The Magi were often talked about of, well, everyday things. A common phrase, for example, in talking politics was that a man needed to be like the Magi of old, someone with a guiding star. In searching, you will find year-round references like this to the Magi in the newspapers. It was much more embedded as a part of everyday culture, not just a Christmas thing in the 19th century. Another thing I found interesting in reference to the Magi was the complete nature of how newspapers reported the biblical references to the Magi. Now, the Magi are barely mentioned in the New Testament, you see. If we want more detail on them, we have to go to the Old Testament and the book of Isaiah. And the newspapers actually did that. Most people talking about the Magi today don't do that. They cling to the same 10 verses in the book of Matthew when talking about the Magi, and they're fine with getting the story wrong. The newspapers in the 19th century went there, and I found that really interesting and very surprising. But where the Magi really had their impact consistently was in the churches.
Thank you.
The first Noel was first published in a book in 1823, but the song actually dates back centuries, as does the words. It was included in another book in 1833 by a man named William Sandys, who titled his book Christmas Carols Ancient and Modern. Frequently, the Magi were the subject of sermons, newspaper articles, stage plays, church pageants, orchestras, and operas. Every Christmas season, they were a theme, every bit as much as A Christmas Carol is today. And the newspapers advertised it all in advance and reported on it after the fact. In fact, it is along the subject of the Magi that I noticed something else about the mid-19th century media. The Magi was the one topic where skeptics could argue against the sacred Christmas and get away with it. You would see around Christmas every year scholarly articles in many newspapers published usually by a heady university professor somewhere who claimed that while the Magi of the Bible were indeed part of the nativity story, well, they weren't exactly Christians. Those articles are a lot of fun to read because in them you can see the embryonic arguments of church and state and the sacred versus secular debates in Christmas starting to form. The Magi were also prominent in pop culture and the 19th century Christmas. It was common in the 19th century to see the classic art of the Adoration of the Magi in museums and old churches and ancient cathedrals of Europe. As pictures became more and more a part of media technology, these images were soon in circulation in the newspapers and in advertisements. American universities also showcased popular galleries at the time of work that featured the Holy Family and the Magi. Of course, the 19th century also created new works of art, especially paintings, that remain popular even today. They include the work of Karl Ehrenberg, a German artist whose acclaim grew in America for his stunning images of the Nativity that you can see online with a quick Google search. A book, also called Three Royal Magi and the Journey to Bethlehem, was translated from German and published in 1850. The Library of Congress has a copy of that book available for download, so I downloaded it and I read it. And I can see why the book was so popular, especially in Sunday schools throughout the 19th century. The Magi were simply just as present and prevalent and prominent in the 19th century as was the Christmas tree, Christmas cards, stockings, and Santa Claus of the era. But it was the music that really told the story of the Magi. By the name of John Henry Hopkins wrote We Three Kings of Orient Are in 1857, the same year that Jingle Bells was written. Historians are not exactly clear on why he wrote the song. Hopkins was the son of a famous New England theologian and Episcopal bishop. After tinkering with the idea of becoming a lawyer and later a journalist, John Henry decided to follow his father into the clergy. He studied at the General Theological Seminary in New York City, made famous by Clement Clark Moore. Neat little connection there. And he became a deacon there, and he also became that institution's first music teacher in 1850. He held that post until 1857 when he wrote this song for a Christmas pageant held at the college. Other historians say he wrote the song for his children, but he didn't have children at that time. He might have had nieces or nephews, but I'm pretty sure he wrote it for this pageant. Regardless, the song bounced around his family and friends and among his colleagues for a few years before it gained widespread popularity when John Henry Hopkins decided to publish a book in 1863 that he titled Carols, Hymns, and Songs. The book did very well as his contribution to it, We Three Kings. In newspapers from 1865 forward, there are plenty of advertisements for the song, billed under the name of The Three Kings of Orient. Likewise, newspapers recorded both concerts featuring the song, and they reported on Christmas sermons that were based on the song, with church choirs performing it. Right around that time, just after the Civil War, and still several years before Christmas was declared an actual federal holiday, we notice a sudden shift in both the coverage and practice of Christmas in the Victorian era. Coming up in our next episode of the Merry Little Podcast is part 3 of the Victorian Christmas, where we dig deeper into the stuff of Christmas at that time. More music, the food, the decorating, and especially the merchandising of Christmas. But more importantly, we share just who those Christmas rock stars were and what kind of influence they held sway over the 19th century Christmas in America. Through these Christmas creators, Christmas all came together in the Victorian era, largely thanks to 3 men, a president, an artist, and 1 very masterful salesman, better known as Santa Claus. Join us at the Merry Forums of My Merry Christmas, where we discuss the splendor of Christmas in every age, every day of the year. And for the Merry Forums, this is Jeff Westover wishing you and yours a very Merry Christmas.